Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of a guy who probably didn't blow Bill Clinton to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the chronocentrism fallacy. Probably didn't blow.
I mean, we can't say for sure.
No, probably didn't. I think we're just asking questions.
Sure. Yeah.
You can't rule it out.
Probably not. We'll come to it later. We'll talk about it later. So chronocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago, we talked about the ethnocentric fallacy, which is reasonably self-explanatory. It's about thinking that your in-group, your ethnic group in many cases, or the country that you live in, is just better, inherently better than others.
Mm-hmm.
For this, it's the same, but with time frames.
Right.
Chronocentrism is about assuming usually the time period that you're in or that you grew up in or the one that you're currently living in is the best.
Yeah.
And it's inherently better than the past, probably the future as well. It's just the most important time. And it is ridiculously commonplace. I mean, we all experience it to a large extent, I think, that we look back on the past and think, oh, they were idiots.
And don't
think that the same of ourselves, putting ourselves in the place of people in the future.
Yeah.
We don't kind of project our minds into the future and think, oh, I'll look back on myself and think, what a fucking idiot he was at that point.
We
think we've cracked it now. We've got it right.
this is it. Yeah, and we're so much better than the idiots in the past. They're all so primitive.
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of thing that underlies the Egyptians couldn't possibly have built the pyramids because
they were... Yeah, well, that and racism.
Because they're savage and not white, and therefore they must have been aliens.
Our first example in this case is Trump when he was announcing the peace deal that he was brokering in Gaza alongside Bibi Netanyahu.
So this is a big, big day, a beautiful day, potentially one of the great days ever in civilization. Things that have been going on for hundreds of years and thousands of years, we're going to, at least we're at a minimum very, very close, and I think we're beyond very close.
Bit grandiose.
One of the greatest
days in the history of civilization.
Right.
I mean... It's a thing that is a problem and would be lovely if it was sorted out. It hasn't been sorted out. You know, it's I think fragile would be the kindest description of it at the moment. It's not really at peace.
No.
And it hasn't been since the deal was signed. Yeah. One of the things about chronocentrism is the feeling that even though this kind of thing has come up before and failed horribly, this time it's different.
Yeah.
This time it'll work. And that's essentially what he's doing here while invoking like most important moment in history and his responsibility for it is ignoring the fact that this has been tried many, many times and it has failed every single time it's been tried so far. There's no particular reason to assume he's got it right. Yeah. Except his obviously massive ego.
Yes, exactly. So in fact, it's a very egocentric fallacy as well. It's that kind of the whole of us, because we are now, we're much, so much better than people in the past. Whereas actually, if he had a little bit of humility, he would acknowledge the weight of responsibility on his shoulders, and the fact that it's been very difficult, and it's a problem caused by people who thought they were solving the problem in the past, and other people who've thought they've solved the problem have failed to solve the problem. But of course, he's got to be the one that is the great white saviour, rides in on his orange-faced horse and solves the problem. And doesn't Absolutely. Matter, actually, whether the problem gets solved. All that matters is he's seen to be solving the problem and seen to be doing so better than anyone else has done. Even if he isn't seen to be doing that, the fact that we've heard him say it is enough.
Because no one's going to remember or hold him to account for anything.
Right. Well, so, if they are, he will just fire them or call them fake news. I've recently come to the conclusion that's the entire administration is about not doing anything at all, but just saying that anyone who says you're not doing anything at all is nasty and mean and fake news.
You've recently discovered this, have you?
Yeah, I think it was Caroline Levitt has finally worn me down. And I think you've just... But you're doing fuck all. But you're just blaming everybody else and covering it all up.
Yeah. I thought that's what we've been talking about for the last 7 years.
Oh, yeah, no, that is true. Yeah. But it's only just sunk in. I've been not okay with it, but I've been kind of ignoring it, because otherwise it would just drive you mad.
You've been compartmentalising.
Yeah, there you go, yeah. And now it's seeped into... into the realm, alarms are going off. You've got a mental health well-being alert going off because it's seeping across into the other compartment where my mental health well-being
basically
resides.
It's like that bit in Titanic where the sections below the waterline that are supposed to be welded off
start to collapse.
Just comes through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, yes. So there are alerts happening. So I'm up on the deck at the moment with my arms out singing. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes this isn't specifically about the time that you're currently in.
Right.
It can be about nostalgia. This can be a driver of nostalgia.
Right.
Which, of course, leads us to one of Trump's favourite sayings.
Yeah.
You know, I had an expression when I first ran, make America great again, right? Very simple expression. I think in political history it's the best ever used.
Of course, not enough just to say it's a really good one. It's the best ever in political history.
But it's also kind of, it's a sort of meta internal Möbius strip flip, isn't it? Because make America great again is an admission that it's awful now. Let's make it the way it was before.
Yeah. And the question, of course, that begs is, when was it great?
Right.
Which has been asked of Trump supporters many times.
Yeah.
And here is what one Trump supporter had to say.
What does MAGA mean to you then? So make America great again. What does that mean to you?
The America I grew up with, we want it back. We want people to stop censoring us. We want them to stay away from our Second Amendment. We want freedom of religion. So if you're conservative, if you're a Christian, if you're white, you're male, it doesn't matter what color you are. We want people to be respected for who they are.
So if you're a white conservative Christian male, doesn't matter what colour you are.
Yeah,
you should be respected.
But all of those things that you talked about, they all exist.
They're all I'm not suggesting it made any sense. No. Of course,
the great that he wants is to have a place that has already existed since 1776.
Yeah. Well, how he started was the America I grew up in.
Yeah.
So that's what really people mean, because it's not the America they grew up in, obviously. And even if it was great for them as a 7-year-old, it wasn't great for a lot of other people.
Yes.
And
yes.
if you ask a lot of different people when was America great, you'll get a lot of different answers.
Yes.
And
yes.
a good chunk of them will be, what the fuck are you talking about? It's never been great for people like me.
Yes. And it still isn't. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people, Trump supporters, will give you answers like when America was founded, and then you point out slavery and stuff like that, and they'll go, oh, well, apart from the slavery, if they're like the nicer kind of Trump supporter.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're like Jordan Klepper has asked this question of MAGA people a lot, and he gets people saying things like, you know, before women were allowed to vote.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the 50s. Oh, so before the civil rights movement. And, you know, yeah, there isn't a good answer to this because there isn't a point in history when it was great for everyone.
No.
And realistically, the only people for whom there was a time when it was great was rich old white Christian men.
Yeah.
Because that's who it was built for and by.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Everyone else has and continues to struggle.
Yeah, the founding fathers wrote their thing to serve their own purposes, but did it using a sort of magnanimous language to say, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Yeah.
Not all of it.
But then they changed the terms by which other people were defined as equal.
But basically what's going on here, and with MAGA as a whole, as a concept, is that they are holding up one period of time as being superior to all others and being the one we should go back to, and are being super vague about when that period of time was, because it never really existed.
Yeah.
Because it is an imagined mythological past that they can feel nostalgia for. They didn't really live through it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a similar viewpoint from all of MAGA, because most of MAGA is white, conservative, Christian. You know, they would be slave owners.
Yeah, but also such a lot of them are not in that socioeconomic strata.
Yes. Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah,
there are some, absolutely. The ones who hang out with Trump at Mar-a-Lago,
yeah,
they're the ones who absolutely would have been slave owners and landowners and people who voted and all that kind of, although not the women.
Though
they continue to hang out with him there. But, such a lot of them are the people who would not have had that kind of money.
Yeah, they were the people that would have suffered in the Depression.
Yeah.
For whom the New Deal was great. That was great.
But so many of them see themselves as temporarily inconvenienced billionaires.
Yeah. That, yeah, yeah.
You know, they'll get there. They'll get there if they just are able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Yeah.
Like their heroes have before they were handed millions by their parents.
Yeah. And it's a similar Boris argument when he was kind of talking about Brexit. He was, and I think we played the advert in on a previous episode where he's harking back to a Britain that didn't exist, certainly one that he didn't live through because he was born in 1964. So you know, he's harking back to the wartime Britain that was written about in the comics that he must have read as a child. So, with Vera Lynn and the White Cliffs of Dover and Spitfires and, you know, all of the things that he heaped into let's get out of Europe type stuff. The very thing that his hero said, we should get into Europe to prevent this stuff from happening again.
So our final example in this section is actually a 1952 political ad for Eisenhower.
Oh, wow.
A TV ad.
Yeah.
Which was, like, one of the very earliest filmed for TV. This was Eisenhower answering questions from actual members of the public. I think they probably gave the members of the public the questions to ask, but they brought in members of the public,
pretending.
filmed them asking the question, and then had Ike answer them.
Eisenhower answers America.
General, the Democrats are telling me I never had it so good.
Can that be true when America is billions in debt? When prices have doubled, when taxes break our backs, and we are still fighting in Korea, is tragic, and it's time for a change.
So this is a direct reference to a campaign slogan of Adlai Stevenson, the guy that Eisenhower was campaigning against at this point, the Democrats, pre the party switch of the civil rights era, were claiming everything's fine, because they were the incumbents.
Yeah.
You know, everything's great. You've never had it so good. Yeah. Now is currently the best time to be an American.
Yeah.
And yeah, this was just post-war. So they had the benefit of being the richest Western nation, essentially, because all of the others had paid so much money and so many lives into the war over the course of 4 years across Europe. And the Americans came along at the last minute and claimed victory. And I think we talked about that in the ethnocentrism one, didn't we?
And,
And yeah, so they by not getting involved for the bulk of the war, they saved an enormous amount of money in putting all that of that manufacturing and weaponry and stuff into place. So they came out of the war being the ones who were then able to invest in infrastructure and invest in the country and all of the stuff that made America a huge manufacturing center and benefited the country. It still was shit for a lot of people. And the things that Eisenhower mentioned in his answer of Korea and that kind of stuff was all so bad. And it wasn't true at the time to say this is the best it's ever been for a lot of people. In many cases, it might be, or is at least perceived to be, the best it's been so far for certain groups.
Yeah, and I guess the thing is, because this was also something that Harold Macmillan said in the UK, and at the time he was criticised for it because, he kind of said it almost as an admonishment to the people.
Yeah, what are you complaining about?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you've never had it so good. And it's not a universalizable sentiment. What it does is blocks out all dissent by just saying, oh, well, it's the best that we've ever had. So even like back to the peace in Gaza, if people kind of complain that it doesn't serve, say, the Palestinians well, that Trump could say, well, this is the best deal ever in the history of civilization. And that kind of shuts things down, down.
And it's also a driver of that persistent feeling across generations that kids today have it easy. Yeah. They don't know they're born.
Yes.
They didn't have to deal with all of the shit that we had to deal with.
Yeah.
They've got it easy. And obviously that is done without considering any of the difficulties that modern kids have to deal with.
Yeah.
Or trying to put yourself in their position at all. It's just the assumption, well, I had difficulties that they don't now have, therefore they don't have any difficulties.
Yeah. Yes, and it's the stuff that levelled against the generation that I'm just the other side of, the baby boomers, that people now complain, they had it great and they've ruined it for the rest of us. And actually, no, it's not the people that were on the receiving end of a really well thought out social contracts such that when you stop working you get a decent pension, those kind of things. They didn't ruin it, they didn't take it out of the system. That's just politicians blaming other people for not maintaining that. But also there's that thought that you kids didn't have it tough, we really suffered. Well, that's quite right. The you successive generations ought not to have to go through all the shit
goal.
You went through.
It's not, sadly. It's harder, I think, to be logically chronocentric about the present, because, I mean, it's demonstrably worse currently than it has been for the last kind of 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Things have got worse, and for the first time, this new generation in their 20s now is worse off and has it harder to kind of survive in society than their parents' generation.
Yeah.
And that's not the way it has previously gone. And I don't think is the way it should go.
No.
You know, we want to make it easier for the next generations, don't we? That's the idea.
Yeah, and the activities of the generation after the war was such that it would be better for... Yeah. And the recipient of those were the baby boomer generation, who received that forward thinking from that generation that said, you ought not to go through all of this shit. It ought to be a lot better. We should leave the place better than we found it for subsequent generations. Then that kind of that runs through my thesis coming up.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
So Margaret Thatcher actually quoted she had a Macmillan's version of Eisenhower's quoted version in 1980 to the Conservative Central Council, where she said, I'm not going to tell you that you've never had it so good, but it is perhaps salutary to remember that there have been many times when we have had it a good deal worse. The unemployment we suffer today is a scandal and a challenge, but it does not remotely resemble the human misery which unemployment meant in the late 20s and early 30s. I know that it's not difficult to find, even today, tragic cases of individual hardship, but it's just not true to pretend that real poverty is a regular feature of our national life.
In 1980?
Yeah.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, a lot of the unemployment is down to her.
Wow.
But there we go, yeah. So she's kind of, she is saying, you've never had it so good. She said, I'm not going to tell you that you've never had it so good. But then she is saying that by devious, well, underhanded, she's,
yeah,
backhanded
she's
moves.
Saying, she's, I'm not going to tell you you've never had it so good, but loads of people have never had it so good.
Yeah, yeah. and, oh, it's much better than it was.
Yeah.
You know, because it's, yeah, it's, oh, just look at it back then. And it was, and this is 1980, when it was not particularly good. It was getting better for certain bits of the society, the bits of society that, say, bought into the denationalisation of utilities and became shareholders of the transport system, the water system, the electricity, the gas, the telecommunications.
I mean, was that was mid to late 80s?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going so off that, my teen
yeah,
memories.
Yeah.
But yeah, so all that, like, Thatcher, that yeah. wasn't even at no. this point. This no. was, you know, they, yeah, there was a boom.
Yes.
In the late 80s, early 90s,
yeah.
which some people did very well out of,
yeah.
and other people still struggled enormously. But this was, like, when was the miners' strike at its peak?
Yeah, that was 79.
Like, yeah, exactly.
79,
so,
yeah.
So this is coming off that and yeah. saying, oh, it's fine, everyone's just yeah. complaining over nothing.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Because Jesus.
That was, yeah, because this was the consolidation of power into government, because basically Thatcher did away with those organisations that were as powerful, if not more powerful, than the government, i.e. the unions,
mm.
because they represented the rights
the
of
working
the worker.
People.
Yes.
Yeah.
yeah. So, yeah, we'll dismantle the rights of the working people and then dismantle the nationalised industries that the working people work for and put them all into private hands and then declare that as a marvellous thing. Which still turns up where people kind of, I think Truss was the last one to say, maybe not. No, Sunak did, where they talk about that. Yeah, Thatcher made seismic changes. Go, yeah, for the worst.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah, seismic's rarely good.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah.
We've seen Airplane versus Volcano.
exactly. That's right. Yeah. So they skip forward to another Conservative leader. This is Cameron in 2016, which is his last speech after resigning as Prime Minister after the Brexit vote didn't go his way.
When I first stood here in Downing Street on that evening in May 2010, I said we would confront our problems as a country and lead people through difficult decisions so that together we could reach better times. It's not been an easy journey, and of course we've not got every decision right. But I do believe that today our country is much stronger.
Much stronger now because we did all the things that I said we'd do. Well, some of them, well, some, no, we didn't. We failed to do many of things I said we'd do. But it's much stronger now than when I came to power in 2010. So remember that date because that's important. So similarly, in 2019, the other side of the Brexit vote, which put paid to Theresa May, who took up office after David Cameron. So this is when Boris had been elected to leader of the party and therefore Prime Minister in July 2019. He's talking about what he's going to do.
Our mission is to deliver Brexit on the 31st of October for the purpose of uniting and re-energising our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth. And when I say the greatest place on earth, I'm conscious that some may accuse me of hyperbole. But it is useful to imagine the trajectory on which we could now be embarked. By 2050, it is more than possible that the United Kingdom will be the greatest and most prosperous economy in Europe, at the centre of a new network of trade deals, which we have pioneered. Our children and grandchildren will be living longer, happier and healthier lives. And our kingdom in 2050 will no longer make any contribution whatsoever to the destruction of our precious planet brought about by carbon emissions. We will be able to look back on this period this extraordinary period as the beginning of a new golden age for our United Kingdom.
If in doubt about the present, i.e. we're on the threshold of Brexit, which he just jumped on the bandwagon in order to become Prime Minister, and it's going to ruin us. If you doubt about the present, let's talk about a future present. So it is not beyond the realms of possibility that in 2050 we could be doing such wonderful things as all of the things that we're no longer doing, all of the things that got rescinded under Sunak and then Starmer. And it's just that kind of thing. It's like, yeah, cats and dogs living together in harmony. Yeah. Our children and our grandchildren will be living healthier, longer, healthy, happier lives.
Flying cars.
Flying cars. We'll all be wearing silver outfits. Yeah. And we'll look back on this time as the golden age. It's not beyond the realms of imagination where we, in 2050, we'll look back upon this as the golden age. Oh, for fuck's sake. So then Theresa May fails to get the withdrawal agreement through. Boris failed to get the withdrawal agreement agreed. Prorogued Parliament, found to have done that illegally and misled the Queen. Held a general election in December 2019. Against all odds, got voted back in again. And here is Michael Bates, Lord Bates, and he's all for this golden age. Here he is responding to the Queen's speech, which was made in January 2020 following Boris's election win the previous December.
The hugely successful government campaign, the Great Campaign, launched in 2012 at the Great Olympics and Paralympics, tells people in 140 countries around the world how great Britain truly is. I think it's about time that we brought that campaign home and reminded ourselves what a great country we're privileged to live in and that our best days lie ahead of us, not behind us.
It's a very convenient thing, this chronocentrism, because what it allows you to do is to say it's the best it's ever been now or the best is yet to come. And and you can exhort people to not dwell on the past.
Well, it would be a pessimistic politician to say it's all downhill from here.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, no, true. But what it means is that you can ignore the past because you're saying, I think what we should do, we should get behind Boris and all his, you know, despite people accusing him of hyperbole when he says the greatest place on earth. Yeah, let's get behind him. Let's be all optimistic and not have any foundations in reality and ignore all of the stuff that's gone on prior to this, most of which we've been responsible for. And in fact, here is Rishi Sunak in June of 2024. So this is post-Brexit and Johnson and Truss doing exactly that.
Is this a better or a worse place to live than in 2010?
No, it's a better place to live than it was in 2010. Of course, I understand that the last few years have been difficult for everyone. We had a once-in-a-century pandemic followed by a war in Ukraine that drove up everyone's bills. And of course, that's been difficult for everybody. But we've also made progress in tackling those things. Inflation back to normal, the economy growing again, wages rising, energy bills set to fall again just next week. And now we're able to start cutting people's taxes to give them financial security.
Yes. Is it better now than in 2010? Well, of course it is, because what's happened is we've got back to where we were before all the things that either we created or have happened.
Yeah. Even those things that he's talking about of like energy bills falling.
Yeah.
Not to anywhere near 2010 levels.
No. No, that's right. And yeah, that's nothing
from
to do
where
with,
they were.
And of course, like, that's nothing to do with him.
It's not as bad as
him.
It's been in the last couple of years.
But that's nothing to do with him. That's all down to the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
However, inflation has gone down, and that's nothing to do with him, but he's claiming credit for that. And the thing is that go back to 2010 and go back to David Cameron saying, well, when I first took office in 2010... Yeah, when I first took office in 2010, it negates the entirety of Cameron's leadership. It just says, oh, yeah, no, it's much better now than then. So it's yet more of it's better, even though you can go back and look at them all saying, we're going to make it better now than it has been up until now. And we'll look back on this and we'll say, this is fantastic. And then you get to Sunak and he just looks back and he goes, no, shit then. It's much better now. And they all do it. And they with no sense of history or irony. And the problem is the other job that chronocentrism does is to wipe the voters' memory of what's gone on before so that you continue to vote them in. And that's just prior to the general election. Here is, by way of contrast, and yet maybe not so much, the other side of the aisle, here is Starmer, pre-election in May 2024.
To leave your country in a worse state after 14 years than you found it is unforgivable in politics, whichever party you support. I fundamentally believe that, and I'm not prepared to see a Labour government that doesn't materially improve our country so that we can genuinely look back in 5 or 10 years' time and say, do you know what? It is better now than it was. We've got more chances, opportunities, equality now than we had before. This country has moved forward, and I've moved forward, my family, my community has moved forward with it. And that's what this is all about. But for that, you need serious missions, you need first steps, you need a different mindset in politics.
So he's doing the same as Boris. He's saying, yeah, in 5 years' time, he's not gone out as far as 2050. He's gone, 5 or 10 years' time, we'll be looking back and we'll think, oh, yeah, it's great. We are materially improved. The thing is that, so we've had Sunak, we've had Truss. He knows full well about Truss. And the problem is it doesn't matter which side of the aisle you are, when you kind of do this chronocentrism thing, all you've got to do is live long enough for it to ring hollow. Even
I'm going to defend Starmer a bit here.
Okay.
Because he's not in power at this point.
No, that's true.
Johnson and his party have been in power for fucking ages.
Mm.
And he's the one saying that thanks to this absolute bullshit we're muddling through right now of the Brexit thing,
this is
the beginning of something great. He's basically... What he's doing and saying that in 2050 we'll look back at this is he's saying this is an amazing thing we're currently doing. You just can't see it yet because,
admittedly,
from up close it does look like a pile of dog shit.
Yes.
But actually, from a distance, it'll look amazing.
Squint, close one eye.
Whereas what Starmer is doing is saying, I'm not prepared to run a government that doesn't make things better. Which I think is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, I guess the thing that rings hollow is we're now a year on from
looking back at this shit.
Right.
Yeah, but at the time, as a thing to say before you're elected, I think it's a completely reasonable thing to say.
Yeah. Well, no, absolutely.
Oh, once you put it in historical context, obviously it's bullshit. Yeah.
When you actually get to the now.
But at the time.
That he's talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah, but he kind of employs the same thing, but with the knowledge and the acceptance of the previous 14 years of government, which is what Johnson and Sunak, and to a certain extent Cameron, weren't doing. They were just saying, oh, yeah, it's particularly Sunak, because he's not even looked at Cameron and said, well, he didn't manage to do it. But we are. He's just saying, oh, yeah, no, it'll all be fine now. It's much better now than it was. Yeah, but you guys, you all belong to the same team. You lot are responsible for why it was shit. At least Starmer's got the virtue of being on the other side and saying, oh, yeah, well, we don't want any of that. I want it to be so that when we get it, 5 years hence, we're all looking back going, oh, thank Christ for that. Yeah, how quickly it all changes, eh?
Questions, but you tell me lies, cause all of the time you're just full of shite. Please tell me if all this is true, cause deep down inside all I wanted was to vote for you. Oh, behaving like a child. Oh, fancies in the wild. Oh, I look into your eyes. Oh,
Modern Romance, of course, there with Best Years of Our Lives.
And in The Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example this week comes from Frasier.
Yay!
And this is the final season where Daphne and Niles are together and trying to get pregnant.
Hello, darling.
Hey, you.
Well, we're all set. I got us a home pregnancy test, a basal body thermometer, an ovulation kit.
Oh, yeah, perfect. I can upload all your data into this fertility program I bought.
You kids sure know how to keep the romance alive. Two coffees, please. Since when do you need a chemistry set to make a baby?
I hear an in my day coming.
In my day, it was simple. Girl would put on something slinky, guy comes home, has a couple of pops, throw some Dean Martin on the hi-fi, and bim, bam, boom, you're light and the lucky.
Yeah.
It's nostalgia mixed with, you know, the new generation, don't know what they're doing, everything was better when I was young,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
All of that built in.
Brilliant. With Dean Martin as well.
On the hi-fi.
Couple of pops on the hi-fi. Yeah. Fantastic. Uh-huh. Something slinky. Yeah. Brilliant.
So our next example is from Quantum Leap.
Oh, yeah.
And this is an episode where Sam has leapt into a college, like the head of a fraternity, basically, mm-hmm, who is making his pledges do awful initiation hazes.
Right.
And trying to defend that.
This whole pledge stuff, it's ridiculous. It's humiliating. I don't know why you do it.
Well, maybe it's like a leftover from primitive times.
What do you mean?
Well, it's like a rite of passage, an initiation. I mean, you know, like in the olden days, when a boy wanted to be considered a man, he had to go out and kill a saber-toothed tiger or something like that.
So then he would be accepted as an equal amongst the other hunters. Is that what you mean?
Exactly.
And so now he has to wear underwear on the outside of his pants and steal basketballs.
Hmm. Which, depending on how you look at it, is either incredibly lame or infinitely more civilized.
Yeah. So in trying to defend, and I'm like kind of disingenuously trying to defend it, because he is, since he's leapt into this guy, having to play this role. He doesn't necessarily agree that the hazing is a good idea.
Right.
But he's kind of, as a scientist, putting it into historical context, he invokes what he calls primitive times.
Right.
When people would do these kind of rituals to prove that they were men.
Yeah.
And the assumption there is that was obviously terrible, barbaric. We would never do anything like that. Ancient, so now we just make them do humiliating stuff that isn't dangerous. Because now it's much better. We're far more enlightened now.
Yeah, much more civilized.
And obviously the great thing about Quantum Leap is that Sam is coming to it from a perspective of someone in the near future. So he knows from the perspective of someone probably 50 years on from where this person lives, that really things haven't changed that much from that point to this point, and we're not that much more enlightened about pledges and hazing and that kind of stuff.
Actually, the underlying thing about Quantum Leap is that he always takes that perspective, so he always goes and is amongst people who think that their time is the most advanced and much better than all previous times, and because he then, you know, leaps from one to the other, he can take not only his viewpoint, but the viewpoint that he's just come from, I don't know, Renaissance, a bit like Doctor Who. You know, he'll come from Renaissance Italy to...
Well, he can't leap outside of his own timeline. Not exactly true. Yeah, he did do it a couple of times.
Yeah. So that, and also quite terrifying that all of Quantum Leap now is set in the past.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, they have rebooted it recently.
All right. Does he turn up?
No, unfortunately, they didn't. He's invoked in it. A character off screen.
Oh, okay.
It only lasted two seasons and they didn't.
Then it just went down the pan.
Anyway.
Yep.
So our final example is from Modern Family.
Yay.
Can people change? Well, that is a tough one, but I would say yes, people can change. That's what I believe anyway. And I will till the day I die.
You do realize you're proving the exact opposite of your point.
So this is actually a really interesting psychological phenomenon that psychologists call the end of history illusion. Mm. The idea that we are where we will get to. We have reached our own personal history in terms of the end of that, in terms of our personality, our beliefs, our evolution as a person.
Yeah.
There was a group of psychologists, Coidback, Gilbert and Wilson, who asked 19,000 people who ranged in age from 18 to 68 to talk about how much they changed in the past decade and how much they predicted they would change in the next decade.
Mm-hmm.
And universally, young people, middle-aged people, older people all believed they'd changed a lot in the past, but would not change much going forward.
Wow.
And of course, the 40-year-olds didn't think they would change much moving forward, but the 50-year-olds thought they'd changed quite a lot in the past 10 years.
The past 10 years, yeah.
And I think this is probably pretty universal. I think I certainly feel it. I've changed a huge amount since I was young, and probably quite a lot over the last 10 years. And I feel like it's hard to predict how you're going to change. Because I guess you would think that if there's a way I could be different in a positive way for me, I'd just do that now. You don't think about the small incremental changes that will take you in a particular direction over time.
Yeah.
But you can look back and think, that was me at 40. I'm very different now.
Because, I guess that's it. Because you don't have the benefit of foresight.
Yeah.
You know, we all can kind of... in the narrative arc of our lives, we kind of go through the chapters and say, oh, yeah, that was that, and then I did this. But then as you set out into the next chapter, you know, if you want, we tend to divide them conveniently up into decades, you think, I don't know, because I wonder whether the moment of leaving school and going to university, where we would see other people that we know that had gone to university, and you think, oh, you're a lot different than when you were at school.
Did you think that, though, when you were at that point in your life? I don't know that I did. I think you think, well, you know, obviously what I do day to day will change, but this is talking about personality, values, the stuff that drives you.
Yeah.
And I think the intellectually honest way to approach it would be to accept that, I will change over time. There's no way of knowing at the moment how.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or picturing what those changes could be or what they could be driven by, because I don't know what's going to happen to me over the next 10 years. But things will happen. Life will happen. And I will be buffeted by it in some way and change things about myself.
Well, I don't know, because I think that even though we think we'll get buffeted, we think that we won't change.
Absolutely. No, that's the standard. If we're being good critical thinkers, if you picture yourself in the future moving forward, and the real world effect of this kind of thinking is that when you do plan for the future, you plan for your current self in the future.
Yes.
So the example that they gave in the study was that people will overpay for future opportunities that indulge their current preferences.
Right.
They'll invest in things that they think they'll still be interested in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a way you can avoid doing stuff like that, because you can really only base what you think will happen in the future on the kind of, on the person you are now.
Yeah.
But acknowledging the fact that actually you're not going to be the same person is a start, I guess.
Yeah.
The abstract for this paper that they wrote in, which is in Science, I'll put a link in the show notes. They say people, it seems, regard the present as a watershed moment at which they finally become the person they will be for the rest of their lives.
Nice. Oh, well, there you go. There it is right there. That's that brilliant, isn't it? Yeah, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Yes, the thing that we should avoid is to not drift slowly right wing as we get older.
Yeah. We're doing a reasonable job of that
so
far.
I
will continue to drift leftwards.
I think we're balancing that out. Yeah.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Okay, so if you look at this game, this is the best version of ever. I mean, just look at how the score is turning out now. It's going to be great, much better than before. I mean, in years to come, we'll look back on all the times I've won and say this was the turning point for the utopia we now live in.
Can't argue with that at all.
No.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. So, the theme, such as it is this time, is kind of word salads, basically.
Right.
It is,
good theme. Yeah, okay.
It's like sometimes you can listen to what Trump's talking about and kind of you get at least a sense that he has something in his mind that he's talking about.
Right.
And other times he's just opened his mouth. and started talking.
Out. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. these are some some examples. Not all from the same speech, which I've been doing quite a lot of the ones that have just kind of follow on from each other recently. Yeah. But then this is different.
This way you get more variation.
Yeah, different times. So statement number one.
Yeah.
The Thanksgiving meals are cheaper than you can now from Walmart get than before. Like more than 3/4 of the price than they used to be, because groceries of all kinds are much lower. They've gone in a good direction, which is down. It's just a true fact. Affordability is a Republican thing, and Democrats are trying to claim it, but it's not theirs, and we can't let them get away with it. Everyone can buy as many eggs as they want right now.
Well, everyone could always buy as many eggs as they want. Well, unless there were no eggs. Okay.
All statement number two.
Right.
Drug usage is way down, and drug usage coming from the sea. They call it ocean drugs, a little term that they use. The ocean drugs is very close to non-existent right now. I wouldn't want to be in one of those boats heading away. You know, they're driving happily to destroy the lives of people, and they end up, that's the end of them. So the ocean drugs and the sea drugs, drugs by sea, they call it also, that's almost down to nothing, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I know that you're having to take great care to read this
it's
stuff.
Almost
out,
impossible to read.
Because it makes no...
As if it makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay. Nothing follows on from... Yeah, okay.
Statement number three.
Yeah, ocean drugs. Yeah, yeah.
Faith-based non-profits are the nation's most trusted institutions interacting with the foster care system and practicing Christians and more. Think of this. More than twice as likely foster care... They'll adopt the general population. They adopt to it so easily. When they get out, they adopt to it, just like it's become second nature. It's amazing. Yet radical left policies in states nationwide make it much harder, not easier, for those families to open up their homes.
It starts off so well, doesn't it? And then it's, what the fuck? It's like, yeah, wow. Okay, well, blimey, this one's hard. Okay. So which of the two did you study in order to make the third one? Okay. Well, the Thanksgiving meals are cheaper than you can now from Walmart get them before. Well, because that was the first sentence of this lot. I thought, oh, well, that's clearly a gym... made up one, but now I'm not so sure. Drug use is way down. Drug use kind of the sea. Call it ocean drugs. All that bit where it goes, faith non-profit, and then, is that something you could have written? Just they adopt it. It's wow. Okay, so I think that the ocean drugs is the one that's jumping out at me is not real. So I think number two is the one that you made up.
Okay, of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
Convinced is a strong word. I think faith-based non-profits are number three.
Okay, and number three is real.
Faith-based non-profits are the nation's most trusted institutions interacting with the foster care system and practicing Christians and more. Think of this, more than twice as likely foster care. They'll adopt the general population. They adopt to it so easily. When they get out, they adapt to it just like it's become second nature. It's amazing. Yet radical left policies in states nationwide make it much harder, not easier, for those families to open up their homes.
So he just...
So what happened here?
Why does he feel it reading necessary a speech. To go off-piste?
Yeah. He's reading a speech, and the speech presumably said something like... Faith-based nonprofits are the nation's most trusted institutions interacting with the foster care system. Full stop.
Yeah.
Period. He ran that on to the next bit, which starts, presumably, practicing Christians are twice as likely to enter foster care than the general population.
Yeah. Yes.
To take on foster care children and adopt children. But he couldn't read that right, and having not read it right, when he started to riff, he confused the word adopt with the word adapt.
And so good.
Then like was and then one needed to make out that he knew what he was talking about. So he was like, oh, it's amazing how easily they adopt to the system when they get out of what? It's Christianity? What the fuck?
Foster homes?
When they get out, they adopt to it like it's become second nature. What is?
What?
None of that makes any sense at all. And then the next sentence is back into the script.
It's just because he can't be seen to be fucking it up. So all he does is appear to be fucking it up all the time, even when he's reading the stuff off the cue. And he's shit at reading it.
Oh, he can't read for anything. He's absolutely awful at it.
And he doesn't like being trammelled in by what his speechwriters have written for him. So he just does it in the most downbeat way. And then it comes to life when he's riffing on the theme of adopt and adapt. And, I've just realised that US spells us. Like, you know, when he's set free and he can say what he likes. And he says.
Apart from running one sentence into the next one, basically to reconstruct from here, to reverse engineer what might have been written down for him, you have to accept four mistakes in one sentence where he goes off in different directions.
Yeah.
And then he riffs on that and gets that bit wrong because he needs to show how well he knows that people like that adopt to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucking insane.
Adopt to it. It's so good. And he says it twice because he thinks it's a bit like when you're typing a word and your fingers run ahead and you think, well, that doesn't feel right. And then you go back to the screen and you go, I have spelled you wrong.
He also has a tendency to have another go at words that he kind of, while he's saying them, realizes aren't quite right.
Yeah.
Like when he said the oranges.
Yeah.
The oranges
yeah.
of the investigation.
Yeah. And then he'll kind of rattle around for another definition. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then he'll try and insist that the first word, you like Covfefe, is back to Covfefe, isn't it? He'll insist that his meaning is the meaning. Yes,
yeah, it's a perfectly cromulent word.
When you talk about where things come from, that's the oranges of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also think the number one.
Yeah.
Is something that Trump said.
Yeah.
And number one.
Yeah.
Is fake news.
Oh, well done. Yeah, that. Nice. Nice. Yes.
He has talked recently about Walmart's Thanksgiving deal being cheaper than last year.
Right.
That's it. The rest of it is bullshit.
Fantastic.
That I made up instead of bullshit that he made up.
He makes up, yeah.
I mean, he makes up. To be fair, the Walmart Thanksgiving deal is cheaper this year, but it's also because there's less in it.
Right.
It's they made it more affordable by giving you less stuff.
Yeah, so. It was that. So that, yes, that construction, the are cheaper than you can now from Walmart get than before.
Yeah, that brilliant. Came from me typing it badly first time and thinking, yeah, fine, I'll just leave it like that.
Oh, right. Ah, brilliant. Wow.
So that means
that means ocean drugs is real.
It's a thing he really says.
No.
Drug usage is way down. And drug usage coming from the sea, they call it ocean drugs, a little term that they use, the ocean drugs, is very close to non-existent right now. I wouldn't want to be in one of those boats heading away, you know, they're driving happily to destroy the lives of people and they end up, that's the end of them. So the ocean drugs and the sea drugs, drugs by sea they call it also, that's almost down to nothing. As you can imagine.
So none of those. Nobody calls that a little term that they use.
I mean, I will admit, I don't have knowledge of the Customs and Border Protection people and what terms they specifically
don't use.
But I'd be prepared to bet quite a lot of my money that they don't call them ocean drugs.
No. It's so good.
Because why the fuck would they?
Yeah, I've got the monsters from Marine Boy coming up in my head, or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. that kind of stuff. Just that's what he's got going on in his head. And the fact when he comes up with a shit phrase, he will also attribute that to
the term. Like I'm using an insider term. You won't have heard of this.
Yeah.
What the people who know about it call it.
That's what they call it. Though it's a little term they use. And they also call it sea drugs.
Sea drugs, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Like if you're really just, you know, talking, if you're just chatting, if you're being less formal, you might call it a sea drugs.
If you're around the water cooler, if I talk about that, drugs by sea, because I have to explain to you what sea drugs means. I've just told you ocean drugs.
You couldn't figure that out from context, could you?
It's a very that's the inner of the
technical
inner.
Term.
That's the casual technical term. That's how in I am with them. That they use their banter words. It's a little term they use. Banter words. Drugs by sea. Oh man,
it's amazing.
Wow.
So, I mean, this was pretty tricky to. Come up with something as insane.
Yeah. And to get the right stumbling cadences.
Yeah.
Which is successful. Because
I think finished it.
Yeah.
Because to be fair, I did this reasonably quickly before we started recording. And I wrote the first one and I thought, I mean, it's not stupid enough. Some of it makes sense. There's like three of the four lines there that make least some sense, like a human might have said them.
Yeah.
But I just had to go with it. But so I'm glad that it worked.
Yeah. Well, it was that. Yes, it was the very clunky, stumbly bit at the beginning. Turned out to be a typing error.
Yeah.
But that's basically what's going on in Trump's head, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Typing error rather than him waiting for it to be corrected, in his head, it's like the numbskulls, isn't it? George's germs were sitting in Donnie's head. There's the guy on the stenographer up there going, oh, fuck, I'm having to talk to him. Oh, no. Right, you just hold him off for a minute. Keep him busy. But no, he's just reading out.
He's like that calligrapher in The Residence.
Yeah. Yes.
He just can't understand anything that he's written.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we do have some social contestants who also were challenged with this on Patreon. Anders says, well done. This is getting harder and harder to be a part of. The game, great game, is also pretty difficult. Well, here goes a wild hunch. Number one is fake, solely based on the Yoda grammar references to Trump's earlier "It only good can be."
Nice.
I guess Jim from Walmart. It got increasingly impossible to nail down what is fake now.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah, with you, Anders. Yeah.
Renee Z says, number one is real in that Trump said it. It's fake news in that the basket of Thanksgiving foods in this year's ad from Walmart contains fewer items than last year. Of course it costs less.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard number two, but can absolutely believe that Trump calls the unverified drugs on these murder boats ocean drugs. That leaves number three as fake news. He knows nothing about non-profit organisations. The very name would make his blood boil.
Oh, that's true. Very true. Yeah.
Becca says, I'm just going with my gut, which is number three. Jim's had so much practice at writing stuff he could have said that I just go with my gut.
Yeah.
And Scott says, how many eggs do I want to buy? I'm pretty sure number one is real. They will adopt to it, huh? That has to be real. And as much as I enjoy ocean drugs, I think that number two is fake.
Yeah. I know. I know. There was something appealingly... Well, I guess there's a lot of hope involved when you some of these, you just, oh, God, I hope that wasn't real.
I did wonder if you might bring up ocean water. You remember when there's a lot of water, big water, ocean water.
Yes. Perhaps that was what was familiar. Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, on Facebook, Gregory says, I'm sure that I'm going to be wrong, but number three looks like the fake to me. The sentences are just too long and don't meander in random directions. Number two has his typical, I'll name a thing and say that's what it's called.
Nice, yes.
And number one, I feel like he really believes that buying an infinite quantity of eggs will mollify the base. Unless, of course, he said number three just after he woke up and took his meds, in which case, who knows?
Yeah, says a thing and then says that's what it is. Yes. Exactly.
Finally, on Discord, Steve Bickle says, these are insane, I have no idea. My D4 said four, so it doesn't even know. I'm going to go with number one, as it took fewer read-throughs to make even minimal sense of it.
Right. No.
Yeah, see, that's what I was afraid of, that it
that's
made
what
too
you're
much
up against.
Sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's time for the part of the show that this week at least is called Trump's Best Friend Jeffrey Was Not a Logical Fallacy, because he's back in the news.
Yeah.
And weirdly, it's not, because the House is back in session and have finally sat the Arizonan representative, Adelita Grijalva, who has since signed on to the call for a vote to release the Epstein files. And there will be a vote in the House next week, which probably will pass, because enough people voted on calling for a vote that if those same people vote on releasing, then that will go through. But then it will go up to the Senate, and the Senate will probably not pass it. Yeah. So it won't it won't probably go anywhere, but you never know. And one of the things that might
stay in the news cycle.
One of the things that might make it more possible to pass in the Senate, which it still won't get enough votes to avoid a veto from Trump.
Yeah.
But let's make him veto it, I say.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things that might make enough senators vote on it to actually force that is it being in the news repeatedly with things like what is happening at the moment, which is largely based on 23,000 documents that have been released, or 23,000 pages of documents that have been released by the House Oversight Committee, which is bipartisan committee, both Democrats and Republicans.
Yep.
And these are emails mostly which were subpoenaed from the Epstein estate.
Right.
And so they are emails that were sent by or to Jeffrey Epstein by people like his brother, Ghislaine Maxwell, Michael Wolff, the author who wrote a couple of books on Trump and used Epstein as a source for some things, and people like that. So there's a lot of stuff that Epstein says in them and that people say to him that is about Trump.
Yeah.
And in fact, of all the people in the world, Trump is the one who is mentioned most frequently in these documents.
Yes.
Over 1,600 mentions of Trump.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And because there's quite a lot of them, it's taking people a while to go through them all and kind of bring stuff up. And like AI can do it a bit. So I'm sure many journalists have kind of uploaded them to ChatGPT and said, can you give me anything juicy?
Tell me all the things that Trump's been involved with.
Yeah. It doesn't quite have the same context awareness that journalism usually has. And so there are still occasionally the odd thing coming up. But over the first few days, some came out that referenced Trump in ways that suggested it is worth continuing to investigate this situation.
Yeah.
It's not proof of anything.
Yeah.
Really? Well, unless you take the written at the time word of one of the worst paedophiles in history that we're aware of.
Yeah.
As gospel. In which case, some of the stuff he says is pretty fucking damning.
Yeah, yeah.
He, in particular, thought that Trump was one of the worst people he'd ever met. Like, he says, I think at one point, I have met some really awful people and he is the worst.
Yeah.
He's gross. He, like, says that he knows a lot about him that would be bad for him.
Exactly, yeah, yeah, yeah. That could be used against him, yes.
Yeah, he offered Michael Wolff pictures of Donald in his Epstein's kitchen with girls in bikinis.
Yeah.
Which, again, not necessarily illegal, not ideal.
Yeah.
He references Virginia Giuffre.
Yeah.
Well, in the version that was initially released by Democrats, the I think the day or the 2 days before the main dump of all of these documents, that particular email was redacted to remove the victim's name. It was something that said that redacted spent hours at my house with him, with Trump. The Democrats have said that they basically want to avoid naming any of the victims because it's not their fault and they shouldn't be named
dragged through
in,
it again.
In these things.
Yep.
And the only people that should be named are the people who did bad things. Hmm. The Republicans worry about that less because they are awful. And
they're trying to actually blame it on the victims.
Yeah, well, Caroline Leavitt mentioned Giuffre
as
specifically in the context of that, partly because she has said that Giuffre previously said Trump never did anything bad with her or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, she obviously accused the Andrew formerly known as Prince of illegal things, but didn't ever accuse Trump of illegal things. And so I guess it's in their favour then to say that it is that that's who the victim that was specifically being referenced as spending hours at Epstein's house with Trump.
Right.
And that, because elsewhere she said he never did anything bad to her.
So the kind of so in this cesspool of villains,
yeah,
that kind of makes Trump the protector of women. If he's,
I think that might be going. Although, well, Caroline Leavitt said that these prove nothing except that Trump did nothing wrong, which it does not prove.
No, it proves almost quite the opposite. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah, one of the messages that Epstein sent to Ghislaine Maxwell,
yep.
He said, I want you to realise that the dog that hasn't barked is Trump, which is a reference to the Sherlock Holmes, The Curious Case of the Dog in the Nighttime. You know,
he is
someone who hasn't spoken to the authorities, basically, is what people are assuming. That he hasn't been questioned, or if he has, he hasn't said anything.
So he's not squealed. Yeah.
But he also said in another message that Trump, of course, Trump knew about the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that could mean lots of different things. But he said he knew about the girls. He asked Ghislaine to stop.
Wow.
So again, like, it probably is being argued by Republicans that, look, he knew about it, he asked her to stop.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. Although, but in the context of the prince formerly known as Andrew, Andrew formerly known as Prince, he did say, yes, I need this to stop, or something along those lines, which say, if this is getting bad for me, I need it to
cease.
Yeah. So when you kind of think, oh, okay, in the email correspondence, the use of the word stop is normally used in defense of their own position rather than...
I mean, it's not much of a safe word, is it?
No. No, well, given that Trump has also been heard on tape talking about how he wouldn't stop and how he has, you know, he just uses it because he's famous, he could do what he likes. At the very least, it would be out of character for him to...
Yeah.
Not be participating in all the things that Epstein is talking about.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. He also, in that same email where he said, of course he knew about the girls, he refuted Trump's claim that he chucked Epstein out of
for
being a creep, basically.
Yeah.
Epstein says, Trump said he asked me to resign. I was never a member, ever, of Mar-a-Lago.
Oh.
I mean, Trump himself has also refuted that, in as much as he said that the reason that he asked him to leave is because he kept stealing members of staff.
Girls, yeah.
That wasn't great. Basically, he comes up a lot. None of them are, you know, things like, oh, I can't believe anyone's asking questions about Trump. He never did anything wrong or anything like that. It's not good stuff. Weirdly, he does say something similar about Clinton.
Right.
He does say Clinton was never on the island or something like that, in reference to people talking about Clinton in connection to Epstein.
Yes.
You know, not that they were never friends or acquaintances or anything like that. They definitely spent time together, but he says that Clinton wasn't on the island.
Well, that runs contrary to what Trump has said. He's been there, you know, thousands of times, just need to look it up. Well, and when you do look it up, Epstein himself said, nope, never came. So that will be more evidence for the Republicans that that's a hoax. Because obviously Clinton did go there because Trump said so. So we've got to believe Trump when he says Clinton went and not Epstein. And then we've got to not believe Trump when he said before that he can just grab him by the pussy. Or that he was friends with Epstein. Or that he was told by Pam Bondi that he was in the files. Or anything appertaining to emails, like I don't even know what emails are. When somebody talks to me about Outlook, I think it's a view out of the window. Or when I've never seen an email. What you mean you can send notes to each other electronically? That's absurd. No, never done it.
I think that the defense of various prominent Republicans, not necessarily politicians, but Republican pundits, suggests the kind of thing that they might at least suspect might be in the files when they are released. Because again, These aren't the Department of Justice files. These are emails from the Epstein estate. So there is stuff.
Yep. Still stuff to come.
There's a lot of stuff that the Department of Justice has access to that they're trying to get released. And Trump and his administration are absolutely trying to stop from being released.
This, the same stuff that they said, oh, yeah, well, when we get into power, we'll release the the files.
But he's been putting pressure, apparently, on people like Lauren Boebert and Nancy Mace, who are signed on to wanting it released.
Yeah.
He's been trying to get them to change their votes.
Wow.
That didn't happen. But yeah, some of the things that some prominent Republicans have been saying, for example, Dershowitz, who was has variously been Trump's lawyer at times and Epstein's lawyer, he went to some length to clarify that Epstein can't be technically called a paedophile because the only person that he admitted to having slept with under the age of 18 was like 17 and 10 months or something. And that's like, it's almost legal. And so 18. Technically he would be an ephebophile instead of a pedophile.
Okay.
So that's fine.
That makes it better. Yeah.
Megyn Kelly said very similar stuff. She was saying, actually, you know, he only really liked people who were like 15 or above. He wasn't into, you know, 10-year-olds or 14-year-olds. Which, I mean, fuck off. This is the worst of all kinds of defense.
Yeah, yeah.
To minimize abuse and rape of children by saying, you know, wasn't the youngest children. Yeah,
they were babies.
In fact, there's a 14-year-old who did a social media post. I don't know what platform it originated on, but I've seen it on Instagram and a couple of others.
Yeah.
Responding directly to Megyn Kelly and saying, like, I'm a 14-year-old. This is the traits of some of the people in my class, my year at school.
Yeah.
How dare you say this is an okay thing? I shouldn't, you know, people my age shouldn't be teaching adults
that this is not an okay
situation.
Yeah. Because that's why the age of consent was changed in those states that allowed that, you know, to, under the age of 16.
So the fact that people like Dershowitz and Megyn Kelly are saying, you know, it's only 15-year-olds and above and 17-year-olds, so not that bad.
So they're saying that Epstein is not a pedophile, so therefore Trump's association with Epstein isn't so heinous.
And if Trump was involved in it as well, maybe he isn't as bad as he could possibly be. It's not the worst.
Right.
That's, I think, what the implication is. Yeah. That, I mean, everyone knows absolutely that Trump was involved with Epstein. There's no question of that. It's how involved he was in what was actually going on.
Yeah.
To the extent we know that he knew about the girls from what Epstein said. And Dershowitz is only saying 17 because he represented Epstein and that's what he admitted to. He was accused of raping much younger children than that. So he's ignoring that and focusing on the one that he actually was prepared to accept in court. And that's based on the sweetheart deal that Alex Acosta gave him.
Right,
ended up with him spending just a few months in prison. So it's fucking insane. There's also, you know, various people saying, oh, the emails are nothing, they don't prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're absolutely trying to stop all the DOJ stuff coming out.
Yeah.
It's very fucked up. It's very bad. And the one moment of levity in it has been a message from Epstein's brother, Mark, who wrote a message to Jeffrey asking if Putin has the photo of Trump blowing bubba, which is what I alluded to in the opening.
Yes.
Because bubba was a nickname for Bill Clinton. And so everyone started making jokes online about the possibility that Trump blew Bill Clinton. And, you know, traditionally Clinton plus blowjob equals impeachment, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But Newsweek got in touch with Mark Epstein and he clarified that the person he was referring to in that message was not Bill Clinton. He did not clarify that the photo didn't exist or that he was joking or that blowing was a reference to something else or anything like that. He was just specifically clarified
that
the person I was referring to was not Bill Clinton.
Wow.
Which is interesting.
That's very good. I mean, even if it's not true, that's worth doing, isn't it? Just to kind of continue to twist the knife into Trump.
Sure.
That's lovely. Perhaps Mark Epstein will turn out to be the nice one to balance out the terrible one.
Yeah, I mean, I very much doubt it.
And on that note, finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
It's November, which means elections in the US, and Democrats had a very good one this time around. Zohran Mamdani won, of course, as New York mayor, which upset all kinds of racists, so that's nice. But there were so many more. Mikey Sherrill won as governor of New Jersey, and Abigail Spanberger became Virginia's first female governor. Also in Virginia, Democrats won the lieutenant governor and attorney general races and gained 13 seats in the House of Delegates, securing their largest majority since 1987.
Wow.
Democrats held all three seats under contention in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, won two seats on the Georgia Public Service Commission for the first time since 2000, and gained seats in both houses in the Mississippi legislature, breaking the Republican supermajority in the state Senate. They gained their own supermajority in the New Jersey Assembly and flipped more than 20 Connecticut towns from red to blue. They also won big on ballot initiatives, with Maine voters overwhelmingly rejecting voter ID requirements and absentee ballot suppression. Colorado voters increased taxes on the rich to fund free meals at public schools across the state. And California voters approved Proposition 50, allowing the Democratic legislature to redraw congressional districts to fight back against Republican gerrymandering. Democrats even won races way down the ballot, including getting rid of a sheriff in Bucks County, PA, who pledged to cooperate with ICE, and flipping a Texas school board who censored textbook chapters about vaccines, climate change, and diversity. Republicans tried to downplay the results, with J.D. Vance tweeting, "I think it's idiotic to overreact to a couple of elections in blue states." Trump claimed part of the reason for the absolute pounding they took was that he wasn't on the ballot. But even Fox News reported that, according to exit polls, 71% of the people who voted for Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey gave their reason as to oppose Trump. Another reason, which even Trump was able to see, was that voters overwhelmingly blamed Republicans for the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Fighting tooth and nail to starve poor Americans while holding Great Gatsby-themed parties at his private club might not have helped. The results were a clear message from the electorate that Trump is in the wrong and they appreciate the Democrats for holding the line and opposing him. Which made it all the more of a kick in the teeth less than a week later, when eight Senate Democrats caved and voted with Republicans to reopen the government with no deal beyond the promise of a future vote on Obamacare from people who have never kept a promise in their lives.
When your administration has a reputation for shutting down and firing members of agencies whose job it is to report on the financial and employment impact of its policies when they produce figures that tell you how badly you're performing, and engineers a government shutdown that so long figures for a whole month are unavailable from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, then why wouldn't you alight on a report from a single commercial enterprise to claim that inflation has been tamed? Especially if that enterprise, whilst once donating big time to an Andrew Cuomo super PAC during his Democratic mayoral primary bid this past spring, was a vocal supporter of Trump's budget this summer. The budget that gives big tax breaks to high net worth individuals like DoorDash CEO Tony Hsu. DoorDash's report seems to indicate that general grocery costs and the cost of cheeseburgers have gone down on average nationally. Despite the Breakfast Basics Index being made up of three eggs, a glass of milk, a bagel and an avocado, those staples of national breakfast, and the Cheeseburger Index showing that the price of a cheeseburger, a soda and a side of fries varies from $10.75 in Lincoln, Nebraska to $25.55, more than double in Anchorage, Alaska. It reminds me of the use of the Mars bar as an indicator of wealth on the basis that the price of one sits in the same percentage of income as it did in 1932, notwithstanding that at over a pound, nobody buys one anymore. When asked if the company feels a responsibility to clarify what this report does say and if inflation has been tamed is a conclusion one should take from the report, DoorDash said, "The White House can use the language that they're using on that. I'm not going to speculate on that, but, you know, we put everything that we feel is relevant in the report." All the information is on the task. A real economist, Daniel S. Hammermesh, Emeritus Professor of Economics at Royal Holloway University of London and the University of Texas at Austin, explained that the White House relying on the DoorDash report for meaningful data is so absurd. If anyone would believe this says anything about the average person, it's just nuts. I'm quite sure as long as they don't have the national information, these guys will cherry-pick information that makes them look good. and pointed out that withholding reliable data is a tool dictatorships use to keep people in the dark. The five-year plan is working, comrades. You can rely on us to know. Don't keep asking awkward questions. Rest assured the gulag has infinite capacity.
Plastic-faced puppy killer Christy Noem has no clue how to run the Department of Homeland Security, so instead she's spending her time funneling millions of dollars to close associates while playing dress-up. According to reporting from ProPublica, the DHS has spent $220 million on a series of TV ads featuring Noem herself, basically telling immigrants to fuck off. Some of the money was used to buy ad slots on TV networks, but $143 million was paid to a company called Safe America Media, a company that was registered just a few days before it won the contract. Mm-hmm. They didn't make the ads themselves, though. They subcontracted out to a company called The Strategy Group. By sheer coincidence, Ben Yoho, the Strategy Group's CEO, is married to Tricia McLaughlin, Christy Noem's Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs. When asked about the Strategy Group's work for DHS, McLaughlin said in an interview, "We don't have visibility into why they were chosen." It sure is a mystery. But we do know they didn't go through the normal competitive bidding process designed to prevent waste and corruption, because the agency claimed the national emergency on the southern border meant that any delay in providing these critical communications to the public would increase the spread of misinformation. By pure happenstance, Ben Yoho also made some videos for Noem when she was governor of South Dakota, ostensibly to encourage people to move to the state, but possibly just to pay his company $8.5 million so she could dress up as a state trooper, a dentist, and a plumber. Wow. That contract did go through a bidding process, with the contract opportunity serendipitously going live the day after Yoho registered to do business in South Dakota. A former official involved in the proposal process told ProPublica that a top Noem aide told them the governor would be angry if Yoho's company didn't win the contract. Wow. It all looks a bit dodgy, to be honest. Charles Tiefer, a leading authority on federal contract law, said, "It's corrupt, is the word. Hiding your friends as subcontractors is like playing hide the salami with the taxpayer." Okay. Unless I've missed a crucial part of the story, I don't think Mr. Tiefer knows how to play hide the salami.
Yeah. What kind of subcontracts is he working on? We're absolutely in the wrong business doing this rather than making movies for Noem. Bloody hell. It's Baroness Moan all over again.
Yeah.
Jesus. Sean Charles Dunn, known to most people as Sandwich Guy, was charged with misdemeanor assault under 18 U.S.C. 111A1, which prohibits forcibly assaulting, resisting, opposing, impeding, intimidating, or interfering with federal officials or employees while engaged in or account of the performance of official duties after throwing a sandwich at a Customs and Border Protection officer serving on President Trump's D.C. Safe and Beautiful Task Force. Both sides want to make an example of Sandwich Guy, the government, as a menace to society against whom that society must, for the sake of law and order, impose punishment, and the defence as a dissident, unfairly targeted for his deeply held ideological convictions. The question is whether the throwing of the sandwich was, as the defence put it, a punctuation, an exclamation mark at the end of a verbal outburst, a harmless gesture that did not and could not cause injury, or whether it was a violent act and a federal crime. The prosecution used language like, "He takes the sandwich in his hand, he cocks it back," saying the sandwich was thrown at point-blank range, and the agent on the receiving end described the impact that, "I can feel it through my ballistic vest. The sandwich exploded all over my uniform. I could smell the onions and the mustard." All the horror. The horror. The defence asked the victim to identify the sandwich. Well, he said he couldn't make a positive verification because he didn't go back to collect it. She pointed out that the paper wrapping was still largely on, the contents essentially intact. "You don't see that there's mustard on it? No. You can't tell there's ketchup on it? No. You can't tell there's mayonnaise on it? No. No lettuce, tomato. In fact, the sandwich hasn't exploded at all." Cross-examination wrapped with the defence questioning the agent about gag gifts his colleagues conferred on him after the encounter. One, a plushy sandwich, another is a felony foot-long patch purchased from a vendor in the city. Agent Lairmore put the plushy on his shelf and the patch on his lunchbox. So even the man supposedly harmed by the flinging of the foot-long finds the situation funny. And the defence summed it up with, The government prosecuting this case in some purported effort to keep law enforcement safe and free from food fights is trying to turn a gag gift-worthy moment into a federal criminal offence. Customs and Border Protection Commander Chief Bovino, currently leading Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago, recently said in a deposition in a case about his team's use of force against protesters and journalists that he has instructed his officers to arrest protesters who make hyperbolic comments in the heat of political demonstrations. And whilst the jury took upwards of 7 hours to find Sandwich Guy not guilty, no matter how you see Sandwich Guy, the government's message in forcing 12 citizens of Washington, D.C. to decide his case even after a grand jury had rejected felony charges is clear. Mess with this government and it will mess with you. And Trump's regime is getting increasingly hard to swallow.
As we know, Trump loves to pardon people who've committed crimes he himself is guilty of. It's like Oprah giving away cars. Fraud, you get a pardon. Corruption, you get a pardon. Sex crimes, don't let the cell door hit you on the way out. But the people he loves to pardon the most are the ones who will either personally enrich him or who broke the law to benefit him directly, like the January 6th mob. He loves it so much, he's pardoning people who aren't even accused of federal crimes. The latest batch has gone to the various conspirators who lied their asses off in court and on TV to try and overturn the 2020 election in Trump's favour. Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, Mark Meadows, Jenna Ellis, Ken Cheesebro, John Eastman and more.
Oh, wow.
It's utterly meaningless, of course, because they were all charged and in most cases convicted in state courts. Meadows repeatedly tried to get his case moved to a federal court, exactly so something like this would matter. But he failed in that just as badly as he failed America. The pardon also covered the 6 fake electors who pretended Trump won in Nevada. And in a lovely bit of ironic timing, just 3 days later, the Nevada Supreme Court revived the state attorney general's case against the 6 after a lower court temporarily tied up the prosecution based on a claim charges were filed in the wrong district. Nevada AG Aaron Ford said that Trump's pardons would have no bearing on our decision-making or prosecution under Nevada state law.
Yay. Gloating like gloaty McGloat-faced Trump has received the apology from the BBC for the programme Panorama editing his January 6th speech in a way that didn't indicate the sufficient passing of time between two lines in his speech, and the BBC vowed to be a bit more diligent in how they edit stuff, like they did when they edited the Queen to appear to be doing stuff before she had done it. But old mobile goalpost McGoalpost faced has said it's not enough to do the thing I asked you to do. Now that you've done that, I can see that you're a putty in my hands. And instead of saying, OK, thanks, don't do it again, he's gone red in the face and told the BBC he's going to sue them for damage to his reputation and good standing and mental anguish to the tune of anywhere between $1 billion and $5 billion, probably sometime next week. We have to do it. Well, you don't, because you got all the things you're saying the edit prevented you from getting, i.e. re-elected. And whilst the BBC and media can be a powerful force, it wasn't that edit of a speech made in 2020 that was aired in 2024 that lost you the election to Joe Biden. Buoyed by the fact that YouTube agreed to pay $24.5 million to settle the lawsuit brought by Trump, following similar settlements with Twitter and Facebook and other media outlets capitulating to the kumquat fascists, Trump is determined to reach beyond US borders to overseas broadcasters. Trump has signalled an intention to bring any eventual litigation in the US state of Florida, where he has legal residency, rather than the UK. Trump would need to prove 3 major components: that the content published was factually false in a way that was defamatory, that he suffered harm due to the false and defamatory coverage, and the media organisation knew it was false and acted with actual malice. You know, the very thing that Trump is known for doing. The statute of limitations on defamation in the UK is 1 year, which has already elapsed for Trump because the documentary aired in October 2024. In Florida, it's 2 years. And he'd have to prove that the edit in the Panorama programme was viewed in Florida. But there's no evidence so far to suggest it's been shown in the US. Also, he'd have to prove he actually suffered that much in losses, said Professor Larissa Lidsky of the University of Florida Levin College of Law. Given that he won the presidency after this and has continued to make money in his businesses, it seems implausible that he's going to be able to prove $1 billion worth of damages. Seth Stern, the advocacy director for the Freedom of the Press Foundation, added, well, he doesn't care if he wins or not. The point is to intimidate and punish those he views as critical to him. Eek, we better check the bank balance, Jim.
Weirdly, Trump hasn't complained that CBS edited his 60 Minutes interview, but perhaps even the dime store ambulance chasers he calls his personal attorneys have refused to claim that he was coherent either post or indeed pre-editing. As it was, he came across as the usual lying bigot viewers love to hate. Among the bigger lies he told were the claim that $17 trillion is being invested in the US right now, which is around double what the White House website claims, and even that number is Walter Mitty levels of bullshit. He claimed he'd saved 100,000 Americans from fatal overdoses thanks to his extrajudicial killings of more than 80 people on boats near Venezuela, which the administration claims without evidence were all drug traffickers. Incidentally, 100,000 people would be more than all the US drug deaths in 2024. He repeated his claims that he's ended 8 wars, that grocery prices are down, that the US has no inflation under Trump, that foreign countries pay tariffs, not Americans, and that the 2020 election was stolen. He claimed CBS put out their edited Kamala Harris interview just 2 days before the election, which was only off by about 4 weeks, and he claimed some previous presidents invoked the Insurrection Act 28 times instead of the actual maximum, which is 6. So maybe he'll sue them for not editing him enough this time. To be fair, they've already cut it down from 90 minutes to 23. I'm not sure there's an editor alive who can make him make sense.
No, not even you with fake news. It's been an odd week in Britpol this last 2 weeks or so. Yep, that's how odd it's been. Keir Starmer's advisers seems to be the source of a briefing that Wes Treating Health Secretary, who, by the way, has no more qualifications to be in charge of the National Health Service than, say, RFK Jr., that Mr. Potato Head, Wes, was mounting a leadership challenge against Keir Starmer for being too boring. Wes was forced to appear on TV, denying this and proclaiming his faithfulness, using the language of the Traitors TV programme, which did nothing to make him appear down with the people, but even more like an out-of-touch cringe-meister. Keir then raged in Parliament, saying advisers briefing against members of the Cabinet was the one thing he wouldn't tolerate, and he would find out who did it. Well, obviously, it was former campaign manager turned Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney, and ensure they get reprimanded. Which obviously he won't. Meanwhile, inside globally respected everywhere beside the UK public broadcaster, the BBC admitted editing together two bits of a Trump speech that were an hour apart originally, so they looked like he fomented a violent insurrection on January 6, 2020. You know, the thing that all those arrested for violently insurrecting said that he did. And, you know, the thing that made no difference 4 years later when he got voted back in. This appeared in an internal memo leaked to the Daily Telegraph, obviously, by the so-called impartiality czar, Robbie Gibb, who formerly impartially worked as Theresa May's communications director, impartially co-founded right-wing news shape channel GB News, and was impartially appointed to the board of the BBC by Boris Johnson. His moaning about the lack of impartiality by the lefty BBC led to the resignation of the Director General and former Tory council candidate and deputy chairman of the Hammersmith and Fulham Conservatives Association in the 90s, Tim Davey. All the other media companies and right-wing parties are having a field day because basically the BBC is their strongest competitor with the largest reach and trust rating in the world. And with them out of the way, they can continue to peddle their shit for money whilst paying no tax, of course. Labour and the BBC, the last bastions of centrist thinking being hollowed out from within. Yeah, fire up the rocket again, Bezos. It's time to leave the planet again.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump, just like our strawman level patrons Chuck Gray, Mike Smith, LT, Colleen Layla, Richard Thunder Hopkins, Will M, Scott, Mark Ruggie, and Abba R. Buchanan, who told us when we met her at QED, we can just call her Amber. Last year at QED, I met the listener, recognised her at QED the year before, because we keep using her full name all the time. And this year, we escaped from Alice in Wonderland whilst contemplating the interconnectedness of all things. And our true Scotsman level patrons, Renee Zed, Melissa Sitek, Stephen Bickle, Janet Uetta, Andrew Houck, and our top patron, Kaz Tui. Thank you so much for your patronage, everybody. Your support is very, very much appreciated. Thank you.
You can connect with those awesome people, as well as us and other listeners, in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallaciousTrump, or in the Discord at fallaciousTrump.com/discord.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time, on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.